Welcome, everyone, to episode 69 of Underserved. Joining me today is Eli Goldberg, VP of Applied Data Science at Current Health. Let's get started.
Welcome to this week's edition of Underserved, the podcast for the rest of the tech industry, where we focus on stories of tech industry leaders, their insights, and their lessons learned. And now, your host, Andrew Jalina.
Eli, thank you so much for joining us on Underserved.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thanks.
So growing up in Marshfield, Wisconsin, like, was there much technology around or what was it like?
Yeah, no, not really. Marshfield, Wisconsin is a small town in the sort of geographic center of the northern continent in the middle of nowhere. It's a strange place. I think it was best known for the world's largest round barn. It's like nothing more than just a really big round barn. I think now it's been replaced, so I think it's even lost that claim to fame. But it's, for the most part, a kind of a farming community. The culture itself is very agrarian, but there's a really big clinic there, the Marshfield Clinic, which is fairly well known for its patient care experience. And while technology, I wouldn't say was at the heart of everything that Marshfield did, for the surrounding industries, I think they did have a pretty remarkable heart of technology that was being driven because of the relationship to the really big clinic. I've always loved computers, and I remember building my very first computer, saving up for it with my friends and building, I think, an Athlon T-Bird 650. It had all the bells and whistles, and I was so impressed by it. Now I've actually gone back to my hometown and looked at that computer recently. It's covered in dust, and the graphics card is like the size of a postage stamp right now. So if you like look at it and compare it to like a 3090 or whatever, it's just, we've come a long way. But I wouldn't say there was a lot of tech in Marshfield.
So your parents were physicians?
Yeah, my parents were physicians. My dad is a rheumatologist. My mom was a neonatologist. And it's kind of interesting because both of those things are sort of at the opposite ends of the spectrum of care, right? My mom with neonatology, there's a lot of premature babies. And my father did a lot of end-of-life care and pain management for people who had chronic arthritis. My dad, at least, became a physician to afford his music habit. Maybe this is the tech that I saw, but we had a digital music studio in our basement. I love playing music. My younger brother was absolutely virtuosic at the guitar. I'm okay at the drums. I won the Battle of the Bands in high school at least once. I feel good about that. But yeah, I think he became a physician to afford his music habit.
What was the name of your band in high school?
Oh man, we had a band called Conflicting Interests. We had one song we called Harold the Spaceship. It was not a very good song, but it was pretty catchy. And I remember when I was in ninth grade and my younger brother, I think, was in sixth grade, I think we had our first concert in high school. I remember my friend's parents calling my parents being like, hey, you know, my kid is telling me, can they be picked up 25 minutes after the bell? You know, I really created a lot of ruckus there with that. But yeah, we played our first concert there in like a small auditorium. And there was my younger brother who was holding this guitar that just like outsized for his frame and just shredding. And so it was amazing. So I didn't really get any attention out of that. Not really. Like, it did not do what I think music is supposed to do for folks in high school. But my younger brother did. And that sort of carried through later in his life.
Now, are you doing any programming at all in high school?
Yeah, so a bit. I think I started out programming like TI-83. There were a couple of courses where it was fairly like C-centric. But I think for me at that time, you know, I was always interested in science and math, but the calculator programming was something that was flying below the radar for teachers and professors in college as well, in terms of it was the window. It was like a cheating tool almost. Like, I wouldn't say that I cheated, but having an opportunity to be able to program these more sophisticated concepts gave me a definite speed advantage in terms of being able to complete homework. But also, I think there's this conceptual relationship that gets built between understanding something programmatically and creating a tool for yourself, and then really philosophically and otherwise understanding what needs to be done. So I think it really helped me learn. But yeah, TI-83.
So do you end up going to school in state?
I did. So something that sort of, I think, helps rationalize my pathway to healthcare is that I'm actually a patient. I have a critical chronic lung disease. I have cystic fibrosis. It's autosomal, meaning that I have to inherit a bad gene from my mom and dad, and that recessive gene needs to sort of be realized. And, you know, the Punnett square, there's a 1 out of 4 chance that two people who are carriers for this gene that it represents in someone that actually has that expressed gene. So I have cystic fibrosis. Thankfully, I'm heterozygous for it.
What does heterozygous mean?
That's a good question. Heterozygous means there are two genes that fundamentally, when they come together, are kind of code for the same thing, but there's different sort of flavors. So imagine that you need Kool-Aid, you know, you need grape Kool-Aid, two grape Kool-Aids to get a grape flavored child. And you can have another flavor Kool-Aid that's like grape-ish, and you still result in somewhat of the same things. It's just less severe in my case. They can also go the other way. So there are definitely two different copies of this gene that can be expressed in both, thankfully for me, a lighter way. So I actually, being heterozygous for cystic fibrosis, has meant that I'm a little healthier on the margin than others who have two copies of a really bad gene, but it can also go the other way. So being heterozygous doesn't necessarily causally mean you're going to be always healthier. So being a patient influenced my selection of colleges. You can imagine now there are some really great drugs that help people with cystic fibrosis. But back then, there was no genetic testing, really. It wasn't a thing. And so my parents were really nervous. Here they have a kid who has this critical chronic lung disease. It's got no cure. It's a terminal disease. And they're going to go to college really far away outside of this care net. It was really tough. So I really wanted to go to the Colorado School of Mines. And two things, I think, sort of resulted in me not going there, but staying in state and going to UW-Madison, which I ended up loving. The first was that I flew out there and the ratio of men to women was really bad. In terms of, it was like 4-1 men to women. I was like, look, you know, I'm in a relationship, but I might not be forever. You know, that seems really weird and very like teenage hormone driven. But in retrospect, that was like a part of my decision equation, was like, you know, what do the demographics look like? And then, you know, I wrote some of my essays and got into a few places, but actually at UW-Madison, I got a really nice note from the College of Engineering where they effectively said, hey, we heard your letter. We saw your essay. And, you know, it'd be a privilege and an honor if you were to come here. We have all these services that if you were to get in trouble, we've got a world-class healthcare facility and the Madison Clinic is very well known. Ultimately, that made the decision. And I think also that kind of helped tilt my brain towards, oh, okay, the care equilibrium, the care environment is really important. And if I can't have all of these people who have helped me become me and help take care of me, when I left for college, I was not a self-sufficient human being, I don't think.
Few people are.
You know, they had a lot of anxieties, but I remember my dad told me one time, he said, Eli, you know, most people think that life begins at conception. If you're a Jewish man, life begins when you get your doctorate. So by the way, this education journey doesn't stop with college. And I was like, okay, cool. Thanks. I'm just going to go play outside now. It's like sixth grade, you know, I don't know even how you parse that, but he was very, very academically focused for us.
Did the fact that the onion comes from the University of Wisconsin-Madison factor into your decision at all?
Totally. I'm glad you brought that up. The onion was such a staple. And growing up in high school, they would bring in and it'd be delivered. And there would be this like rush in the morning, the day the onion would be delivered, to read this magazine. And, you know, I wrote a bunch of articles in high school. I was involved with a newspaper and I'd written a bunch of articles that were comedy articles. And actually one of them won comedy award. And I'll just sort of pitch you on the vision here. I'll just try to paint a picture with words. At one point in my high school career, I was frequenting Perkins, which is this like kind of mediocre breakfast restaurant with a really big American flag. That's like part of the thing. And so there was this like subset of humanity that would just sort of always be in there. And you know, that like stereotypical cliques that exist in high school. So I went there one time and I just seen some sort of magic show where this guy had taken a packet of creamer and slyly in a conversation held it up to his eye and then stabbed it with a fork. The idea being like, okay, this fork stabbing, people were meant to take that as real. And the milk kind of looks like the intraocular fluid. And so I did this. And of course, like I massively messed it up and ended up stabbing myself in the face. And I totally missed the creamer packet. And I had these like three marks on my face. So I wrote this article and I thought I was going to get just a ton of laughs, but like it mostly got kind of a lot of like concern for my hand-eye coordination, as well as like, are you okay? And of course the people who I was trying to demonstrate this to, my God, I thought I'd killed it, right? But then they looked at me with no amount of incredulity. They were just like, hey man, you're bleeding. And I was like, oh no, see, it's a packet of cream. And they're like, yeah, we understand what you were doing, but you've stabbed yourself in the face, young man. Why would you do this? It was just, oh man, self-immolation levels of anxiety that came out of that. I was embarrassed. And then I finally tried to turn that into positive energy. So the onion was a huge part of the culture in Madison. I think by the time I actually got there, it was kind of moving out of Madison, but I met some of them. They were all brilliant writers. It was a big part of it.
You are listening to the Underserved Podcast. Underserved is produced by Syrinx, the developer-founded, developer-run software consulting company. For more information, visit syrinx.com. That's syrinx.com.
So you were into geological engineering. That was a bachelor's you got, along with a couple other degrees, but that leads to some relatively dangerous locales and assignments?
Yeah. You know, I felt like I'd been sheltered. And so I really wanted to study something that kind of combined the hardcore science that I liked, where there was a really programming heavy area, with being outside. So geology, geological engineering, geophysics is a really interesting study of the environment in which you're using geophysical methods to capture the invisible. I mean, I love geological engineering. I had some great professors. One professor was involved with declassifying GPS. He was a former Air Force, and he was like, yeah, I did this. And I was like, oh my God, that didn't just always exist. And, you know, there's some interesting things that went along with that, like plate tectonics. Like, we all think that, cool, we've known that forever. But the reality is that discovery was only able to be understood with GPS. There are other things too, like GPS being one of a few areas in which a relativistic correction is necessary because of the speed that satellites are moving and the signal speeds. So it was a really interesting intersection. You know, I did geological engineering. I did geology and geophysics. I had a great time. I did a lot of field work. I'm not sure I like fit in with those type of engineers, right? I felt like I had the smarts, but in terms of cut and dry personalities, like geoscientists, no offense, like probably going to get some hate mail for this, but like pretty dry, pretty boring. I had an opportunity at the end of college where, I mean, two really big things happened to me that really changed where I wanted to go and what I wanted to do. So I told you that I felt sheltered, but midway through college, I had a bit of a healthcare discovery. You know, I knew I had cystic fibrosis because they had done what was called a sweat test. And that's not an acronym. It's literally some physician like licked my leg and was like, oh yeah, this kid's extra salty, like some sort of pretzel. It's a very weird thing. And it kind of harkens back to a lot of what philosophy and science, like physicians weren't always these white coat scientists. Here's this genetic disease. It's diagnosed by licking people. And part of early entry documentation that I got from UW-Madison, they said, look, we have this really great CF clinic. Why don't you come in and get this new genetic testing done? And that was actually the first time that I learned that I was heterozygous for it. So I didn't know that until I was kind of junior year of college. And it changed my whole world, because what that test had done was to identify that I was not going to die. I'm not getting as sick as I thought I would. Is this just, you know, the care that my parents gave me? Is this the medicine that I'm on that hasn't changed in years? But it turns out it was genetic. And I really discovered from that I wasn't going to die. And I started to reevaluate my whole life, who I hung out with, the activities that I was doing, how I wanted to dedicate my life. And, you know, I was already on this path, we had this momentum to go into a geological engineering, a geophysics-based career. And then I was like, oh, wait, I have all this extra time. I thought it was going to be a way for me to fly around the world and like visit interesting places and get paid to do so. You know, I had this moment where I was like, oh, wow. That changes my perspective. I have to start planning long term. And so, you know, when I did that, I started reaching out. You know, I talked to a bunch of oil and gas companies, but I ended up really harmonizing with a small environmental consultancy. And I was a kid. I didn't know anything. So I signed with this environmental consultancy, and I didn't even walk for my own graduation. Like 6 days before I was supposed to graduate, I got a call from a guy who was like, hey, I need you to be in Angola in 6 days. And I was like, okay, cool. I'll just go to Sub-Saharan Africa. Didn't ask any questions. You know, I just wanted to be like that guy who was like, okay, yeah, you need it. Like, I'll do that. And then I spent months in Angola. It was a rough time. It was dangerous. I was on site very early in a small village on the edge of the Congo called, you know, Soyo. The site was owned by a combination of oil companies that had collectively come together because they were, I don't know if you've ever seen an oil and gas platform, but have you ever seen like one of those big flares? And you're like, why is this oil, gas? Why is stuff on fire? Well, the reality is that is a pollution control method. And they flare that flammable gas because it burns pollutants and turns them into effectively carbon and its base constituents, which is way better for the environment. So it's a pollution control method, but it's fuel. And so in terms of thinking about the density of hydrocarbons, like gas is on the top. So every time you drill a well, you're going to get gas. Then you're going to get the fuel in multivarious chain lengths. And then on the bottom, you're going to get water, which is the most dense. And so they were just essentially burning this product. And so they're like, maybe we shouldn't do that. And individually, maybe this gas product isn't worth it for us. But collectively, if all of these oil companies come together, we build this liquefied natural gas plant, we can extract some value. The payback period on that $4 billion facility and expansion was like 3 years. You know, they debated for years about whether or not they should do it. But just to give you an idea about what the ROI is on stuff like oil and gas platforms. So I was there. I was just an idiot kid. You know, I flew out and I remember being on the plane. I was in first class and I remember sitting next to this like grizzled man. I think his conversation to me consisted of like, hey man, where are you going? Oh, you're going there? Cool. Well, I'm going to get really drunk. And because this is the best time I'm going to have in the next 3 months while I'm on rotation in the oil and gas industry in Angola. And I was like, okay, I'm like 22 and like, that's pretty intense conversation to have like right away. And sure enough, this guy, you know, got drunk on a plane. And I learned a very valuable lesson there that surprisingly didn't learn in college, which is if you get drunk on a plane and the flight is long enough, the worst thing is you wake up and you're hungover on a plane. And that's like way worse. But then I proceeded to spend months in Angola and I had a bunch of problems. The way that the policy worked, they came up with some sort of government agreement where you could arrive with your passport. You had to do a little bit of pre-work, but you could arrive with your passport. You would hand over your passport. And then, you know, the idea was they would process your work visa and sometime down the road, you would get it. I handed my passport over when I arrived and I didn't get it back when everybody else was getting it back. And I ended up getting stuck there for months and months. When they asked me to go to Angola, they said, okay, you can go to Angola. We need help there, but we also need help in Iraq. And the difference in pay between these two areas, one was a full-out war zone at the time, was 10% difference. So if you would go to Angola, you would get 90% above your base pay. And if you go to Iraq, a full-out war zone, you get 100%. And I was like, oh, I'm gonna make a safe choice. I'm going to go to the 90% one. Like, come on. It was like only 10% quantifiably less dangerous. You know, I was hanging out with people on site who came from a very different area than I did. So I came from Marshfield. There's a great clinic there. It's pretty agrarian, pretty slow. I was hanging out with ex-South African special forces who were doing the de-landmining on site with a knife. You get on the ground and you poke around in the soil with a knife. So it's like, hey, small, undersized, young Jewish man, critical chronic lung disease, just finishing up college, hasn't really traveled around a whole lot, to, okay, I'm right next to these people who are handling the unexploded ordnances, who have been habituated to violence and have come from former South African special forces insanity land. And now we're just like hanging out, expected to get along, you know, don't have a whole lot of things to say to each other. The water cooler talk, you could imagine, like pretty wild. But, you know, I got trapped there. And I remember calling my brother and I just said, hey, I'm trapped in this country. I have a copy of my driver's license and this piece of paper that says I have a passport. I don't know where my passport is. I'm running out of the medicine that I need critically, and all the packages that my parents and other people had sent me with medicine in it had been stolen. And I just had to have one of those conversations. It was like, I don't know if I'm going to make it out of this, man. When I got back from that, I had a bunch of other dangerous stuff happen that was just such a weird juxtaposition from my former life that when I got back, I really started to think, okay, why do we do this work? What is it that I have said yes to? And is this the direction that I want to move my life in? Here are all the problems I had. I was far away. No one could take care of me. I wasn't getting my medicine. And I felt so helpless. And I did then think what most people, you know, do when, you know, the economy starts to tank and have had these profound experiences. I went back to grad school. I just said, you know what, like, I can't do this.
What's the least dangerous place on earth that you could choose for grad school?
Yeah, Switzerland. I headed off to Switzerland, exactly. Thinking of where I go, that was hard. You know, I applied to a bunch of places, but my number one choice was to go to ETH. And safety was like, and I felt like if I went to Switzerland, they've systematically avoided war for like, what, 800 years? You know, like, cool. Seems where I wanted to go. Switzerland was a really great destination for me because I felt like maybe I was the most dangerous person there coming out of Angola where I was experiencing all this stuff, you know, and going then to the relative silence of Zurich, the relative organization of a really well-greased machine in terms of focusing, I think, on the right things, environmental policy, cleanliness, recycling, environmental stewardship. You know, it's the home of the WHO and UNEP and core technologies like the internet. And it was a really profound decision. I'd also been bitten by the travel bug and I'd kind of learned to love that level of independence. Familiar with like Outward Bound, right? Outward mm-hmm. Bound is this troubled youth almost activity where they teach people independence. And like, man, I was dropped in the deep end in Angola. It's like, here you've been sheltered your whole life, unexploded landmines, violence, everything's getting stolen, like deal with it. And I really caught the travel bug and being also in center of Europe where everything is accessible by train, assuming you have money. An anecdote on that is I saved up a ton of money. I was like, oh, I'm gonna live in Switzerland, I need to save money. I think I spent everything that I had in like 4 months. It was rough. I was poor and hungry.
I am altering the scope of the project. Pray I don't alter it any further.
Excellent. Let the scope creep flow. Keep adding features. To deploy the release, deliver first. You must.
I find your lack of faith in change management disturbing.
Missing your deadline is the path to the dark side.
If you or someone you know manages software development projects, we can help. Call the offices of Syrinx Consulting. Syrinx provides software consultants who hit the ground running to help you deliver right away. Our toll-free number is 888-579-7469, option 1. Or you can live chat with Berg at Syrinx.com. That's Syrinx.com.
Syrinx is not a law office and this is not legal advice. Offer valid only in the United States. Hablamos español, pero solo un poco y no tener ni pies ni cabeza. Saludos.
So after graduating, do you decide to kind of found a company and tackle some of the problems that are close to home?
Yeah. So remember when I said I felt helpless and I wanted to know what was going on with my health? I needed help. I really wanted to understand the relationship between all the medicines and devices I was taking and using and what the impact on my health was. And that technology just did not exist. And so in between my master's and PhD, I actually moved back to Boston and started a business where the purpose was to sort of go beyond the pill and create fundamental technology that would help understand how and how well I was using my medical devices and beam that information back to me in a way in which I could understand the relationship between what I was doing and what effect that was having on my health outcomes. I created a company, made a bunch of early entrepreneur mistakes, you know, hired the wrong people, did the wrong stuff. I even, you know, I got $1 million Swiss grant and didn't pay myself with it.
What was the name of the company?
The name of the company was called Aware Engineering. I chose that name because there's this concept of being aware of your own health that I found really profound, both in terms of the access kind of issues, but also that sort of self-reinforcing type interaction that you get if you were programming your TI-83 in high school. You know, that sort of quantified self, really detail-oriented analytical folks like myself. Like, I felt like I really just wanted to know, and it was hard to do. And of course, I also built this stuff to be the first patient. Like, I really wanted to be patient zero. And actually, I was really shocked when I would be pitching the company to investors, and they'd be like, why are you doing this? You know, because I was sensitive. I didn't want to lead with, actually, I'm trying to solve the problems for myself first. I realized that the investors weren't betting on the business model. They were betting on me as an entrepreneur. And so I quickly learned to sort of weave this narrative about the relationship between technology, its impact, being aware of all of these problems, monitoring, managing them, and then the opportunity that that could create in the healthcare ecosystem.
You had an all-expense-paid trip to China where you noticed another seminal moment as well.
Yeah. You know, starting a business and doing a PhD, I'd been honing my skills for years, trying to build this business, trying to raise money, trying to understand the narrative and articulate it in meaningful ways. And I was invited to join what's called a bio-business competition. And functionally, it was people from all over the world that were coming to Novartis, and they were being taught about the impact of drug development, the drug development cycle. And then they were tasked to group up and create a business that then they would effectively pitch. So the Novartis internal investors would effectively observe or monitor or audit, you know, be the panel for these groups of individuals. And of course, the problems that were teed up to us were real problems, right? Real healthcare problems, real tech delivery problems, real fundamental human and biology. And it was awesome. And so, of course, you know, I joined a bunch of students and, you know, this was my second career, right? I was already in the oil and gas industry. I'd been trying to make this business. It was like going toe-to-toe on Twitter with like a grandma who is, you know, trying to insult the president you like and you're a professional comedian. Like, I just wiped the floor with them. You know, why? Well, I'd spent a ton of time appealing to this direct audience and trying to articulate that narrative. So I won the whole competition and I got a really cool flash drive that was really nice. But the big prize was an all expense paid trip to China to see the Great Wall, to see they had a new campus that was just being opened there at the time, as well as to see the manufacturing facilities. It was great. It was terrific. That said, one thing I thought was hilarious, but they didn't really think it was that hilarious. My Twitter handle at the time was PandaStabber, which was an old gaming handle that I had. So I had this gaming handle of like PandaStabber. I have no idea why, but like it stuck over the years. And of course, they all wanted us to tweet this. They wanted this social presence. And it wasn't really that early in the social media game, but like going to China with and tweeting on the Novartis corporate account, like at PandaStabber, having a great time in China, like really not tactically good. It was funny, but not good. But you know, at the time, I also took it to be a bit of a proving ground for some of the technology that we were making. And so, you know, I had taken along the fundamental equipment and sensors of one of the earliest versions of this technology, and I was tracking my adherence real time. And, you know, it's an all expense paid trip, right? You're out and about. There's like a whole agenda, like the Chinese government shuts down a big museum for you because it's Novartis and you get to go look at all the Chinese medicine exhibits. It was awesome. But I wasn't as adherent as I should have been. And I remember getting a call from my wife over Skype in the middle of the night and she just harangued me. You know, she was just like, hey, you built this system. Guess what? I see you. I see through you. Like, I know what you're doing. Like, do your medicine, use your equipment, do your breathing treatments. And at that point, I just was like, oh man, this is going to work. It's not just me anymore. It's my wife. And could be my family, it could be my doctor. And that idea, that concept, keystone was sort of set in place in that, you know what, we might not have all the tech that we need to make this work, but this is possible. And when it's done right, it can be really transformative for understanding and helping. And the care economy around you, not the finance stuff that's down the road, but all of the motion around taking care of other people, this could be a really profound weapon in a really tough war of chronic disease.
Now, next step in your career is working at Novartis. Was it through folks you met during that experience?
Yeah, in many ways it really was. So I love Novartis. And so when I went around and tried to sell the company, you know, I eventually got some interest, but Novartis was like, look, we love you, but your technology isn't ready yet. And so we're going to pass. And after things wrapped up, I came back and they were like, okay, cool. You left that. That's great. We didn't want your technology, but we'll rent your brain for a couple of years. Would you like to come and effectively run an early internal entrepreneurial effort called the Genesis Labs? Do you want to be one of the core members of this internal entrepreneurial team and help translate early stage med tech from the lab into the clinic, focusing on digital endpoints? And I was like, cool, I just did that. You could have bought the company, but like, cool, let's do this. And so they had teed up a really fascinating intersection of sensing technology that had come out of a small, really innovative group within MIT that was actually an indoor radar. So this is not my technology, but we worked together closely with the MIT folks to essentially do a lot of the things that I really care about, right? Which is, okay, you have this profound new sensing technology. So what? Why is it useful? To what degree can we observe the things that we need to, right? Drugs don't work for people who don't take them. They also don't work if you can't tell they're working. And the mission in that lab and the mission of my team was really to answer that so what question. How does digital change the paradigm of the way we study drug development, the way we create drugs, the way we understand drugs? How does it change the way that we can understand, is this stuff working? Is it not working? And the effort itself was really aimed squarely at some of the really toughest targets. So the technology itself was an indoor radar. It was like a Wi-Fi box that sat on the wall, except from the wall, it could track non-invasively multiple people moving throughout the house. When you were stationary, it could extract things like breathing rate. And when you were sleeping, it could do things like sleep staging, which is a huge pain in the tail if you're a researcher, right? To go into the sleep lab, you have to have full PSG, polysomnography, like setup, where you have 45 sensors on your face, you're wearing a breathing belt. It's like impossible to get any sleep, but here comes this technology. You can do it without touch. And so I love the concept of moving from wearables to invisibles. Obviously, there are security and privacy hurdles to overcome in that area. And that was a lot of what I learned was the narrative is great, but will people use it? Does it make a difference? How heavy is the interpretation of the data? Do you need a massive data science team? Do you need 10 PhDs to figure out what this means? And if you do, then its utility is moderated by its applicability. I'm really proud of it. And I still keep really in close touch with my friends, and many of whom have stayed, some of whom have gone on. Others have joined me in other places I've gone. I was at CVS Aetna. A close friend who I was really close with at Novartis sort of came to be a director who was initially going to report to me. He was not happy about that, but then I made a jump to Current Health. It's been a profound journey, and I really believe in the power of medicines. And, you know, as a lifelong patient, it was a dream. It was a dream.
Now, you learned a good amount about IoT during this. Can you give us a quick 2-minute aside on what was CropNuts?
Yeah. CropNuts stands for the Crop Nutrition Laboratory. Just before I joined Novartis, you know, I'd moved back to the US, like just wrapping up the business and trying to take care of stuff there. And, you know, I got a cold contact from like a Kenyan agriscience company. And my PhD wasn't focused in healthcare. My PhD was in chemistry and bioengineering. I developed nanomaterial transport models and tried to reconcile limitations in transport theory with machine learning, right? So a lot of the stuff that I was doing with aware engineering, a lot of the model concepts were predicated based on fundamental similitude between the way that things are transported in the human body and environment and all these kinetic processes that happen there and the same things that happen in healthcare with your devices and with the medicines you're taking. So there was a lot of cross-pollination in terms of the models and approaches there. It was still pretty squarely aimed in an environmental space. Every year I ran a case study for the WHO on DDT, which is a pollutant, but a fundamental, incredible pesticide, probably responsible for single-handedly removing malaria from what we call the developed world, but it's been banned by the WHO. There's some nuances to that, but the reality is it's one of those examples in which here the developed countries were able to take advantage of a critical innovation and then block it to the rest of the world. The director of this Kenyan agriscience company had reached out to me because of some of my research in the nanomaterial space. So I was looking at nanomaterial transport in the subsoil and using some of the first machine learning models in that space. And so I began to get a lot of messages from folks all over the world. And so I was really kind of ahead of the curve there somehow, but I started to get letters and requests to collaborate. I didn't want to be an academic, right? I wanted to run AWARE. But I received this really impassioned note from this Kenyan agriscience director who said, look, we've collected side-by-side near-infrared spectroscopy samples against wet chemistry. And that's a lot of words. Effectively, what it means is in order to test soil, you need a soil sample. And Africa is massive. Testing soil requires shipping. It requires chilling. It requires time. It's incredibly labor intensive and it's incredibly expensive. And actually, the cost of taking a soil sample in sub-Saharan Africa was like in excess of $100 per sample. If you're a small landhold farmer, you don't have $100, right? Like it's very much so a different economy. And yes, there's cash and yes, there's other things, but you know, they just weren't able to get the information that they needed from these soil tests about which they could create plans to add soil amendments that would dramatically change their ability to grow crops, right? So having the right soil amendments, having the right fertilizer is critical. I mean, you don't know unless you test what the soil needs in order to increase yield. So the idea was this, I want to take these infrared spec readings and I want a machine learning model that's able to ingest this near-infrared spec and predict the wet chemistries. And I want to be able to do this in a way in which we don't have to take a bunch of soil and ship it to a lab where it sits for weeks. We can do it in field or in a truck for pennies. And so that's what we did. So, you know, I helped create their data science team. We made some of the first models. The performance was like very good. And, you know, we helped them drop the price of soil testing for small landhold farmers that were working with this agriscience company, CropNuts, from like more than $100 per sample to like somewhere below $6, which cracked open a cottage industry there of, you know, this type of testing. And that innovation, that consulting work was so motivating. We even helped make the product work. And, you know, everything was done with cell phones. There was no like landline technology, right? So it was all done remotely. And it was just a really awesome application of machine learning, of data science, of fundamental technologies that can change dramatically the paradigm in which people are living. And some of the success stories there are remarkable. Now, Jeremy and the CropNuts people, I have a tremendous amount of respect for them. And always the plan was, look, we don't want to do this work for you. We want to create competency. And so during the tail end of our engagement, and I was really loving the people management aspect of it, where I was really helping to develop their young data scientists, thinking about the staffing plans and helping them really stand on their own 2 feet. And man, they did it and they're doing awesome now. We did great work. I'm very proud of it. It was a blast, and I'm, you know, was happy to be a small part of their innovation.
Now, after that, you do end up doing some work here for two giant companies that merge, CVS Health and Aetna. I guess, why does a chain of drugstores get together with an insurer, and how do you help them?
CVS Aetna at the time was just coming together. And so, you know, I made a career bet. I was sort of poached there from Novartis. Effectively, the pitch to me was really incredible. And they effectively said, look, CVS is one of the world's largest pharmacies. One out of every three Americans gets their prescription pharmacy benefits from CVS. Aetna is a really big insurer. And theoretically, an insurance company is incredibly well incentivized to keep people healthy, right? Why? Because they pay. You know, there are lots of ways that insurance companies, I think, are traditionally known for not paying, but actually the best way is actually to keep people healthy. A pharmacy by itself is actually not well incentivized to care for people. And that may seem like heresy, but I think it's also true. As a pharmacy, they grow when people get sick, right? People get sick, they get drugs from their store. And so as a macroeconomic lever, they're actually, I think, poorly incentivized in many ways to actually help people. And so the acquisition of Aetna by CVS, I think, was an interesting alignment on incentives, in that they thought, look, if we could test and learn things, if we could really create value in the healthcare economy that was valuable to an insurer, if we could create programs, clinical programs that credibly drove or drive med cost savings and value with for an insurer, and we could route the opportunities through which that value is driven through CVS, through its 10,000 stores and its MinuteClinics and its health hubs, then we would have a win-win, right? CVS is getting this diverted traffic, this activity through which they're driving value in interesting ways. They're stealing value from others, but they're also creating healthcare value. The insurance company is driving better outcomes because CVS is a really interesting lever. Of the levers that an insurer has, they can send letters, they can call, but having a closer access to care is a really remarkable weapon in this war against chronic disease. And their pitch to me was really profound. They said, look, you've spent your career developing fundamental technology and using data science in innovative ways. We need someone to come in to shake things up and to lead the chronic care section of the clinical analytics vertical within CVS Aetna and be the data science backbone, help us make smart decisions in this economy. It was kind of a departure from the stuff I was doing, right? It's not hardcore tech that's in someone's face. It was actually this really profoundly wonderful experience to have this massive data set and to create fundamentally impactful models that help address something that I didn't think about at the time as a patient, which is access, right? 80% of America is within, what, 3 miles, 5 miles of a CVS. Are there things that we can do if we understand a longitudinal member's history that could help us really drive value for them? But also the credibility aspect was really profound. So CVS's approach resonated with me as a scientist, resonated with me as a patient, which is it needs to be credible. To what degree, literally between treatment and control, are the programs that we're making driving value? The theory there and the approach that I took was, if it works and you can measure it, then all of these games that, you know, these healthcare companies play with, like, hey, this is how we're providing value, nobody cares. You want to know how you're showing value? Show me that you impact the bottom dollar. Show me you drive clinical outcomes. I want to see the data, right? I want to see this treatment and control view.
I thought it was interesting how you were describing what I often hear in telecom. You know, they talk about the last mile, like, Verizon or whoever running the copper or fiber to your house and kind of managing that. This was like the last mile of healthcare. Like, what do people touch most often? Their local CVS. But then when I saw Current Health was owned by Best Buy, I was like, the guys that have the Geek Squad have this? What made you want to go there and what are you up to there?
The last mile of healthcare is hard. I learned this at Novartis. Getting a device into someone's home, trying to understand if your drugs are working and to what degree. The Venn diagram of people who need help and for whom technology can help enable, and those that can set up a router in a complicated, like, you know, VLAN situation is almost zero, right? So a lot of the key advantages that I think the acquisition creates are kind of a smart entree into a real healthcare space. And I think Best Buy in general hasn't been known traditionally for its healthcare place, but I think it's making some serious acquisitions. And I think Current Health is maybe the, in many ways, the cherry on top that really exposes the Best Buy strategy for approaching healthcare. And that's tech is here to stay. Getting tech into homes and the logistics that are associated with it is not a trivial activity. And the connection that we create through the personal experience, through the engagement, and the fundamental way that we care for that and make technology work still needs work. And this is a really incredible way to align incentives and priorities to help get devices, to help get healthcare into people's hands. I think one of the few areas that there's been a tailwind because of the pandemic is definitely the acceleration of healthcare in the home. And fundamentally, Current Health is a device agnostic platform that shifts the site of care from traditionally high acuity hospital environments for those who are, you know, severely ill or need that type of care to the home. And we're not the only ones who are in this space. I think we're the best. There's a reason why I've gone from Fortune 4 and made a choice to go to Current Health. It's not an accident. It's because as a patient, as an entrepreneur, as an engineer, I see this as the continuation of a lot of the things that I care very deeply about and a lot of the ways that I thought were weaknesses systematically from pharma and big payer, big insurance. And it's this. If you're a pharma company, you have limited trust. It's just true. Like, it's not spicy, right? Pharma companies, every other week, you're reading about, hey, this person did this, this did this. It's hard. But the reality is that trust is a real deal, right? Like, when you think about the things that limit our ability to make care, everyone's like, even if we could personally save everybody from drowning, some people just wouldn't want to be saved because they're so afraid. They don't trust the technology, they value their privacy, and that's okay. But you can't ignore it. You have to lean into it. You have to understand it and try to work with it. At big payers and an insurance sort of side and pharmacies as well, the levers through which you can move people are nudges, right? I could send a letter. I can tell your doctor something. I can text you. I have an app to work with. I loved my time at CVS, but ultimately as a patient, I felt like I wasn't doing enough tangibly. I didn't really feel as much as the impact. I've helped millions of Americans. I feel amazing about that, but I'm nudging them. And I wanted a bigger lever through which to bend the world a bit harder. And Current Health and Best Buy offer an interesting opportunity, I think, to do that because they allow a level of sophistication with monitoring, which was really aligned with my early vision. They've cracked the code on how to understand and engage with physicians and to make it valuable for them, not only in terms of the key economic levers that drive the healthcare economy for healthcare providers, for physicians, but also for pharma as well, right? Digital clinical trials. Actually, I'm talking with more of my old friends at Novartis and Pfizer and Roche and Biogen than I have in the last couple of years at CVS Aetna because we're starting to intersect again. And so I think Best Buy does seem like a bit of an odd duck, but actually I don't think it is. Because I think the relationship between medical devices and our lives are becoming the business of consumer commercial technology. It's been commodified. The expanding commodification of a meaningful sensorization is really incredible. And so I think Current Health does something that I think is really unique, which is of the subset of things that people should do, payers and providers and physicians and everybody, they can only afford a smaller subset. Right? They're limited because, look, it's a healthcare economy. They need to make money. They need to pay people. It's just kind of the way it works. And I think Current Health is a technology, a platform, an approach that's one of the greatest tools in our tool belt to help decrease the marginal cost of care by shifting where it's delivered, right? It's way cheaper to monitor people at home. Imagine all the nurses and the equipment. Is that really necessary? Well, for some people it might be, but for some people it might not. Allowing our ERs and our inpatient hospital areas to be able to create a virtual ward that allows them to take in sicker patients also increases their billing paradigm, right? And I mean, there's a million things there, but the reality is that we're decreasing the marginal cost of care, which I believe is critical to expanding its access. And so I think as Current Health continues to drive, I think what we're going to observe is an expanding subset of critical devices up and down the acuity scale. So whether you should be in the clinic and we're monitoring you at home, not should be, but like whether we can monitor you at home, but before you were locked in to be in the clinic, to the lower acuity cases where, hey, you've got diabetes, you've got hypertension, we're just trying to manage you, creating the value landscape, getting it down to the commodification level and using Best Buy's critical resources to be able to make sure that logistically it's well managed, that people are using it and creating that trust is something that I don't think can be done by a pharma company. I don't think it can be done by payer. People trust Best Buy. I mean, Best Buy, I think, is also great. They're a very women-led organization. They're a great place to work. They really care about helping. They have great insurance policy for those of you I'm trying to hire after this. But like the reality is they have an institution that's very highly rated. They're very centric on this. And actually, I would argue, I think the trust that people put in their technology purveyors is massive.
I would agree. You had a phrase at the beginning when we were setting up the podcast. You're talking about making any significantly complex technology work, that there's a thousand miracles that happen. And I think that Best Buy's brand, including the Geek Squad, is making sure that all 1,000 of those miracles happen so that the delivery happens, the magic happens, and the end-to-end experience. And now that we're pushing healthcare and healthcare analytics into the home, it does make sense that they're helping to bridge that last mile. So Eli, thank you very much for joining us on Underserved and sharing your stories and experiences with our listeners.
My pleasure.
And we'll talk to everyone soon on the next episode of Underserved.
Thank you for listening to the Underserved podcast. For more information on the topics discussed and for show notes, visit the show website, underserved.fm. And please be sure to rate, like, and subscribe to Underserved on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts.